I don't know. There's something so totally guileless and non-sarcastic about her delivery. Like, she sings this kind of tricky-sounding melody in a way that sounds so simple and so sympathetic to the meaning of the song. Like, her heart is totally... She's totally on board, you know, with the composition. It's kind of a rare thing.
This is Essential Tremors.
I'm Lee Gardner.
I'm Matt Byers. The idea behind this show is to have musicians and other creators talk about songs that shaped who they are. We're not looking for favorite songs, necessarily. We're also not looking for songs that they'd choose to take with them if they were stranded on a desert island. What we're looking for are songs that have significance to them. Songs that might have changed the course of their creative lives, or their lives in general. Greg Saunier is the drummer for Deerhoof, a band that originated in San Francisco in the mid-1990s and that has proven to be prolific, enduring, and relentlessly ambitious. Led by Saunier's ferocious drumming, which he does on a minimal bare-bones kit, and completed by bassist and singer Satomi Matsuzaki and guitarist John Dietrich and Ed Rodriguez, Deerhoof combines sugary, sweet-voiced pop with outright noise and even free jazz elements that sound like no other band before or since. Saunier, a Columbia, Maryland native, spoke to us by phone from his home in Los Angeles. The first song Greg chose as being essential to him was Burt Bacharach and Hal David's 1968 hit, sung by Dionne Warwick, Do You Know the Way to San Jose?
Dionne Warwick, I mean, I would talk about first because that was like, you know, music that I actually did grow up on. You know, when I was a little kid and I would hear the radio, it was on whatever station my mom was playing, and she was really into soft rock, so that's what I was hearing in the 70s. So songs like Do You Know the Way to San Jose were actually current at the time. And I think, you know, people have rarely agreed with me on this, but I pretty much think of Deerhoof as being a soft rock band, and our songs being very much in that vein of, like, you know, pretty easy to sing along with, but, you know, maybe a little bit kind of... something a little bit going funny with the songwriting itself. And I definitely think of Burt Bacharach that way, the one who composed the music to that song. And that was, like, you know, a huge hit. But she was singing his song. And you know, the song is like... It's like, if you know it, then it's really easy to sing along with. It's super catchy, but at the same time, it's not really a generic melody or a generic chord progression. I think everything about it is actually really creative, and you know, the lengths of phrases are all kind of irregular, and it keeps changing keys into unexpected, you know, zones. And I don't know, you can start getting into really nitpicky stuff, like if you think of a phrase that she sings, like, do you know, that one starts right on beat one, but then you think of second section is like rest A is a great thing. And so there's this like variety, there's this constant shifting in the way that he's written the song, that, I don't know, I just think it's it's like a little bit, what's the word? It's like makes it a little bit complicated, but at the same time, that just seems to make the song that much more fun to sing along with. And then once Deerhoof formed, you know, many decades later, and Satomi, our singer, joined the band. Like, she came over for an audition in our kitchen in San Francisco, which is where we were practicing at the time. And it was like, she must have been like completely terrified. She had only just arrived to the United States from Japan, and like was like looking to make friends, and just like was like, oh, maybe I should try and join this band. I mean, it was incredibly random. She'd never been in a band before. She comes over to our house. We've got this big German Shepherd running around during practice. Like, I'm playing drums with chopsticks and stuff, so I don't bother the neighbors. The bass player's playing through this tiny practice amp. And she's just got no idea what's going on. But then she starts singing, and like within seconds, I was like, okay, this is our singer. I knew this was the perfect singer. And one of the reasons was that the way she sang, that I think is kind of a product of karaoke, which is kind of the only musical experience she'd ever had, is that, like, you know, you're kind of singing in a way that's a bit, what's the word? It's kind of blocky, kind of stiff, you know? It's like you're singing the notes and rhythms in this really almost unemotional way. And of course, Do You Know the Way to San Jose? Like, the lyrics, but I think the guy's name was Hal David, the guy who wrote the lyrics. You know, it's incredibly bittersweet. You know, this feeling of regret you know, it's a very emotional song. You just got a lot of feeling in it, but actually Dionne Warwick sings it with a really nice expression. But on all these Bacharach songs, including that one, if you listen to the instruments, there's always some trumpet playing the melody, or like an organ or something, playing it in this really stiff, kind of choppy way that has no vibrato and no expressive like indication at all. It's like almost like robotic, you know? The performance of at least the instrumental part is this really robotic thing. And to perform this like emotional song, you know, this kind of tearjerker in this robotic way, it's just like, as soon as Satomi joined the band, I realized this was going to be a huge model for how we should, you know, just like our whole aesthetic. I mean, it's like completely, I mean, talk about formative. I mean, I think it really helped form our aesthetic, because maybe it was a little bit like the opposite of that song, because there the instruments were playing in a really mechanical way, but Dionne Warwick was singing in a really expressive way. And in Deerhoof, maybe it's sometimes a bit the opposite. That Satomi, the singer, is singing things in a really mechanical way, seeming to lack affect of any kind, but then the instruments are playing in this really expressive kind of exaggerated way. But still, it was like, as a songwriting model, it was like, this is the kind of song to write, you know, something that could be performed, you know, on like a Casio or something that just is like the most inexpressive instrument you can imagine, and that somehow, like, the song has to be good enough that the emotion comes across, even if the performance, even if the performers aren't like milking it or whatever. So, yeah, I love that song. I know your podcast isn't about songs I like, but I also happen to like it. And it was hugely formative for our band and continues to be. And whenever I get stuck when I'm trying to write a song, I think about like that, like trumpet sound, you know, in Do You Know the Way to San Jose, and like trying to write a melody that could be played by that same sound, that same instrument or whatever. And then all my problems get solved.
Yeah, I was really happy to hear you bring that song up and Dionne Warwick
cool.
for background, because I think, you know, in the last several years, if only because of stuff like Austin Powers,
yeah.
David have gotten, like, you know, they've gotten their share of the credit. But
yeah, totally.
When I was a kid, I always loved Dionne Warwick's voice, and I loved those songs when I was a kid. And a lot of it is her. I mean, they get a lot of credit, and they should, because, you know, as you point out, they sound simple, but they're not simple at all. But she does
right,
such
exactly.
a great job. She does such
yeah.
a great job of singing them with emotion, but she's like really super precise at the same time. So I can
yeah, exactly. She's kind of got the best of both, and it's like, I don't know. There's something so totally guileless and non sarcastic about her delivery. Like, she sings this kind of tricky sounding melody in a way that sounds so simple and so sympathetic to the meaning of the song. Like, her heart is she's totally on board, you know, with the composition. It's kind of a rare thing that she makes, I don't know, she makes a kind of tricky sounding composition seem very approachable and accessible, and she has this incredibly friendly sounding voice. I think I immediately grabbed onto it when I was a kid, you know. I just loved it, and my mom had the record, you know. It was like a Dionne Warwick's Golden Hits. It's still an incredible record cover. It's completely gold, you know. You almost never see a metallic finish on an LP cover, but this thing is completely gold, just to, you know, front and back, with this it's just black on gold image, a kind of psychedelic looking drawing of Dionne in like these in this flowing gown or whatever, that's like drawn onto this gold background. We actually, Deerhoof has a song called Black on Gold, actually. Maybe it was Gold on Black, I can't remember. Something like that from the early days. And I'll leave it up to the listeners to guess whether or not that's about a Dionne Warwick greatest hits collection.
The second song chosen by Sonya as being formative to him was 90s hip-hop duo Jungle Brothers' Book of Rhyme Pages.
I think was kind of early 90s hip hop that like, for some reason, some strange coincidence happened. This was just before Deerhoof formed at all. I heard a cassette of several songs of what would eventually be released. But the thing is, this album was incredibly delayed by its record label. It's hard to imagine something like this happening now, but this was a different climate, you know, in the early 90s of everything was the artist versus the label in terms of creative control. And I forget what label they were on, but you know, the jerks at the label were like, no, the Jungle Brothers, this record is too weird, we're not going to release it. And the thing finally came out, like, I think like 2 years later or something. I mean, it was so ridiculously delayed. By the time it came out, it's sort of like the moment had passed, and then the record kind of flopped. And it was, I always thought that that was a huge tragedy for some reason. Like, my roommate in 91 or 92 was friends with a guy who was friends with the person who was producing this record. And he happened to make a cassette of some mixes of some of these songs. And we would listen to this thing over and over and over, and we just couldn't believe it. It was, you know, there was a song on there called 40 Below Trooper. Really funny song. And then this song, Book of Rhyme Pages. But I cannot tell you how many times I've listened to this thing and how intensely formative it was for, I don't know, just like, not just like what Deerhoof ended up becoming, but just like my idea of the purpose of music, because I don't know, just on so many levels, it was like, first of all, it's completely filled with completely insane sounds. It's really hard to find this song, actually. I looked for it on iTunes like about a year ago because I was like, whoa, whatever happened to that song? And it's literally not there. 40 Below Trooper doesn't even exist at the iTunes store. I think I ended up finding the song on YouTube, and that was the only place that I could locate it. So, you know, it's not exactly the most famous song, but it should be. This thing is filled with so many funny sounds. what it sounds like is going on this thing is just like, it was kind of an era of massive amounts of sampling. And I think maybe Public Enemy had a lot to do with sort of setting the tone of just piling huge amounts of samples on top of each other and creating this incredibly dense track where you kind of really had to, like, you kind of had to flex your ear muscles to try and figure out what in the world you were hearing. There was like one teeny little snippet of this song and a little blip of that song and a fragment of another song, all mixed together in a totally unexpected way where things were all in different keys and put onto different beats of the measure or whatever. So that everything that might have been familiar if you heard it by itself, when it was combined with this stack of sounds, suddenly became refreshed and totally new, and that the meaning of the sounds was totally changed. Well, this was a lot like that. Really dense, tons of samples, lots of instruments going on. And I just sort of imagine Jungle Brothers in the studio just like, I don't know, just very freewheeling, just kind of improvising on the spot and finding crazy sounds, either off of record or just with a microphone or like hitting something or like making, you know, finding some squeak or some buzz or something that just happened to be, and just here, sample this, and then building the track like so painstakingly with these millions of layers of stuff, until the result is so unfamiliar sound. It just doesn't sound like anything, you know. The drums don't sound like drums, and the bass line doesn't sound like a bass, actually, on that song, Book of Rhyme Pages, the bass line is being played sounds like by a bass clarinet, which is one of my favorite instruments of the orchestra. And, you know, I mean, ever since then, you know, I've been wanting to have Deerhoof's bass lines be doubled by a bass clarinet player. You know, the closest we've come is that Satomi recently got a pedal that she plugs her bass through that's like a Mellotron. Mellotron was that sort of instrument made famous by the Beatles that you hear on, like, you know, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds or something, where it's kind of like a 60s sampler. Like, it's got samples, it's got recordings on tape loops of various instruments, and this Mellotron pedal kind of imitates that idea. And so you play the bass through it, and you can have the sound of some other instrument, a sample of some other instrument playing those same notes at the same time. And there's a clarinet setting on that, so we've been using that lately as an homage to Book of Rhyme Pages. And the other thing was that when, like, a couple of years ago, I wrote a piece for classical instruments for a chamber group that where the bass lines are all played by bass clarinet, and I'd just been, like, years wanting to hear that sound, you know, to hear the Deerhoof songs being done that way on bass clarinet as the bass instrument. And it's really just all came from Book of Rhyme Pages. But the I think the biggest thing about Book of Rhyme Pages that was like formative is, I think, just the kind of, like, the sense of humor of it. I mean, it's an incredibly funny song. It's this kind of rapping where like there's almost no syncopation. You know, the rhythms are incredibly, also maybe a little like the Dionne Warwick thing. It's like the rhythms are very stiff and they're very simple and not not too sophisticated. Like, it's really easy to rap along with this song, and which of course comes across in an ironic way. It's like this kind of oversimplified rhythm in the voice that makes you smile or makes you giggle when you hear it, and the words are so funny. But at the same time, it's like I mean, as I understand the song, just from the lyrics, it seems to be about kind of comparing the news as it's portrayed in the media, you know, of the time. That was the early 90s, but nothing has changed. The way news is portrayed, or what world events are selected to qualify as the news versus, you know, like, members of the population who are not part of a corporate media structure, but just who are regular people. And in their case, they're talking about the history of hip hop itself. They're talking about the voices who created that genre and who propagated it, as almost forming their own kind of news or their own kind of literature or their own history, totally from scratch and without the validation of that, you know, mass corporate structure. And of course, the irony is that that's exactly what happened with the record. You know, the stupid execs at their record label thought the record was too weird and delayed its release for so long, and it was sort of like this self-fulfilling not so self-fulfilling, but it was like more like they saw into the crystal ball. Even in their own lyrics, they saw the music's rejection by some kind of like corporate head, you know? But when you hear the song itself, it's like there's that underlying feeling of revolution in it. But on the surface, the song sounds so lighthearted and good natured and kind of, and very humorous. I feel like, more recently, like that band Nerd, kind of picks up from that same tone. Like, you know, the lyrics are really quite serious if you look at them. And they're also incredibly smart. But the tone that comes across appears on the surface to be lighthearted and kind of jokey. And that sort of combination of the lightness and seeming totally unpretentious on the surface, but below the surface, it's an attempt to completely rewrite history, and it's an attempt to rewrite the rules of a musical genre, or any musical genre. Who cares about the genre? It's just it was so musically revolutionary, you know, that was something that was huge for us too, and that we've always, you know, taken as a big model, at least for me. Yeah, I love that song.
Well, I love that record too. And
you've heard it?
Yes.
Oh, really? Okay, cool. I've never found anybody who knows it. I thought it was like, I thought it just like died, you know, when it came out.
Well, there were a few of us, I guess.
But right, okay.
I have to say that one of the things that I've always thought about that record is, while it's a great record, I understand kind of what happened to it. Because, you know, it's sort of front-loaded with all those great, fun, you know, golden age hip-hop jams. And then as it goes on, the record just gets weirder and weirder and weirder. And by the end, it's like falling apart almost.
Yeah, so exactly.
It's sad what happened to it, but I'm not completely surprised.
Exactly. I mean, it's like the record is the story of its own, you know, of its own suicide or something, you know. I mean, it's incredible to think of it that way, you know. It's like 2 years before the fact, they were writing lyrics about what was going to happen in 2 years when the record label finally, you know, got around to trying to put this thing out. I guess the relationship between bands and record labels, it has changed now, of course, but, you know, the record labels are still at times kind of in the business of preventing music from being released. That happens a lot, where it's like, you know, a label will try to acquire an artist, and then the artist is very excited that they have the opportunity to release some music, but then the label will choose, for whatever reasons, their own reasons of financial or calendar reasons or optimizing release dates and stuff like that, will choose to delay the release of the record for so long. And in a lot of cases, the artist had been shopping it completely finished for months before this record label even, you know, heard it and decided to take it. So by the time the record comes out, sometimes it will be delayed another year or two. And the music will be so old by that time that it's just like, when you feel like when Beyonce has the chance, because she's so enormously successful, to just unannounced, you know, release a record with no, you know, lead up campaign, no PR, except day of, and no like need to shop the music around different labels and wait for the label to no longer delay its release. You just feel so envious of those artists that can be like, okay, I finished this 5 minutes ago. Send, you know, press send and that's it. And then everybody in the universe hears it. It's like, wow, you know, that would really be something. But for most of us, there's a huge gap between the creation of the music and it's actually being heard by any audience.
I'm curious. Did something like hip hop make much of an impact on the way you play drums?
Oh yeah. I mean it still does. And not just hip hop. Sorry, not just hip hop, because obviously a great deal of hip hop. Less so now, but particularly in that time period of the early 90s and late 80s, the kind of drums you would hear on a hip hop record were almost always sampled from funk records, and so you know, I mean, that style of drum playing is something that I'm just always, you know, struggling to match up to, let's say. And I remember, you know, one of our peers as a band is the Roots, and I remember me and Satomi going to see the Roots play in San Francisco in the really early days of the band, like within maybe 6 months of her joining the band. I think it was 1995. And the Roots were already getting pretty big. I mean, they're a little older than Deerhoof, but and they certainly were, you know, reached a level of success within the first year of Deerhoof. The Roots were already more successful than Deerhoof has ever become. But I just remember seeing the Roots live. And Questlove, their drummer, you know, who I'm so thrilled to now call a friend, and that we've played a lot of shows together. But at the time, just so blown away, you know, because, I mean, for a drummer to watch Questlove not only be a cool drummer, but also you can kind of tell that he's sort of leading the band, you know. And there aren't too many bands where the drummer is the leader, except really annoying ones like maybe Buddy Rich or like the Eagles or something that you would never want to be like in a million years. And then here's this band that's giving off nothing but really good vibes from the stage, but it seems that all of the brain, no, not all of the brain, but something about the direction of the music seems to be very much coming from the drummer, or at least a combination of Questlove and Black Thought, the rapper. And you know, the show ended with this like 45-minute song, you know, this medley of that was kind of related a bit to that song Book of Rhyme Pages, because it was about the history of hip hop music, and it was just snippets of covers from decades of music. I mean, you couldn't believe this band, and I just the audacity and the ambition to attempt something like this on stage. You know, it seriously was about 45 minutes. I mean, to see a band play a 5-minute song, you know, on any stage, it's like pretty breathtaking. But then you'd look at Questlove playing, and his drum set was tiny. He's joked to me in the years since then about how his drum set's gotten big again, and he feels like he sold out when he sees my drum set, because mine's like his was in 1995. It was totally stripped down. It was nothing, you know? It was a snare and a hi-hat. He may have occasionally hit one tom, or occasionally smashed one cymbal, but basically everything came down to just kick, snare, hi-hat, and that all of the thinking of that medley, like all of the music of decades of pop music and R&B and, you know, spanning all kinds of genres in the middle of that medley they did, could all be perfectly recreated by just his sheer human power and ability to recreate these beats with just the most minimal setup. And he didn't need a bunch of sound effects, you know, in order to allude to these different moments of musical history. He could do it all just with his touch and with his sense of rhythm. And yes, I was completely, I mean, that was really early days of Deerhoof. I was completely blown away. So was Satomi. And that was a huge moment for the beginning of Deerhoof, absolutely.
The final song chosen by Sonier as being essential to him was Little Walter's It's Too Late, Brother.
Four songs, and now I'm stuck. I'm going to choose a. I'm going to not talk about Igor Stravinsky's Symphony of Psalms, Movement 3, but instead going to talk about something equally religious. It's called Little Walter, It's Too Late, Brother. You know, the other two songs I'm talking about, like when I was a child, you know, I heard of Dionne Warwick, and maybe in the very, just as Deerhoof was just about to start, like a couple of years before Deerhoof, I heard the Jungle Brothers song. And the Little Walter, I had never heard Little Walter at all until it popped up in this, what was it? It was like a Netflix documentary about Keith Richards. And he was going on and on about Little Walter, and I was like, well, I should just see what some of this music actually sounds like. You know, you can hear snippets of it in that documentary. I'm a Keith Richards fanatic, but I was like, let me check, you know, this music, and found a bunch of songs, and I guess, you know, I kind of bought them and filed them away and sort of just had them sitting in iTunes, but hadn't really listened through to them yet until late last year. There was a, just like, I decided to move cities from New York, where I'd been living for 7 years, to Baltimore. And the move was pretty sudden. And it was for romance, and you know, it felt like a lot of you know, sort of personal upheaval and taking a big chance, you know, for love, that kind of thing. And you know, it was so, I don't know how to explain it. It was like so tumultuous. I mean, it was, of course, very happy, but it was, it also felt like one of those, I don't know, one of those crossroads in one's life where one feels like one has to make a big decision or make a whole bunch of big decisions all at once. As you might know, because we had a mix-up about what time zone I was in, and I thought we were having this conversation 3 hours from now because you're on the East Coast, I've since moved from Baltimore with this same person to Los Angeles, which is where I am now. And just in the span of just a few months, like, I've completely moved everything twice to two different cities, started a new relationship, totally from almost from like zero to like moved in really fast. And it, you know, it was a lot of strong emotions all the time, and a lot of pressure. for everything to work, you know, like you're taking a huge chance in your life. But if it doesn't work, you're kind of screwed because you've packed up your entire life and put it in a U-Haul and moved it to this person's apartment. And then you've done it again with the person, moved to a totally new city where you've never lived in your life. And the stakes feel really high. So the emotions are running really strong. And when this started happening late last year, I suddenly found that like a couple songs by Little Walter just magically seems to like hit the nail on the head for the way I was feeling. And actually not just express the way I was feeling. It wasn't that. It was more like an antidote. It was like medicine, musical medicine. And I really love thinking of music that way, that it has use in your life. It's music isn't only about getting a high rating on a music review website. It's something that's meant to be used by a person to help them in their daily life. And I was feeling like I needed a lot of help. I needed to be kind of strengthened and to find some part of myself that wasn't being emotionally tossed, from one extreme to the next, like it often feels when you're in a new relationship and you're in love and you're losing your mind, And so, the kind of like attitude or ethos for me that's like coming across in these Little Walter songs and in a lot of that early electric blues, Little Walter, I think was Muddy Waters' harmonica player. And so that, that was the more famous, of the two, but Little Walter also made records on his own. And, but the same ethos comes across in the Muddy Waters records that are more well known, which is this, an attitude towards life's troubles, and it's often a cliche that people talk about the blues as a genre as sad music, or it's about sadness. But it's like you listen to Muddy Waters, you listen to Little Walter, these songs are incredibly funny. They actually are not sad at all. And this song, It's Too Late, Brother, if you saw the lyrics on paper, you would think, geez, what a sad song. But you hear it's like this up-tempo, really danceable. And you realize what's going on. I mean, at least for me, this is the way how I took it. The suffering or the life's foibles and tribulations is sort of the premise that you're starting from in the song. But then the singer is taking an attitude towards those tribulations and foibles. A philosophical attitude that is kind of, giving a name to life's troubles, and calling it things and kind of making light of it in a way as a way to cope, so it's like a coping mechanism for trouble and, partly by using humor and also by using a really, I mean, the sound of Little Walter's records, and definitely on this song, It's Too Late, Brother, is so ragged. You can tell it's recorded with one microphone or maybe two microphones, maybe one for the vocals or something, all live. The guitar just sounds like it's played through a tiny amp turned all the way up. It's just the harmonica, the way he plays it is so often bent and distorted. His sound is distorted also through an amp that's quite distorted, and he's bending notes a lot in a way that make them sound it's actually very precise, but you could never play it on a piano because he's playing notes that are in between the notes of the piano. And everything about it just sounds like it's coming from this sort of broken place, but is nevertheless full of energy and full of so much life force and like dancing and moving and hilarious and performed with so much, I mean, such a commanding, you know, charismatic, you know, undeniable human presence, you know, when you hear the performance of this song, that you're just like totally, you know, convinced and swept up in the power of this thing. So it's like, it's kind of like humble and sort of screwed up sounding on the one hand, and not just sounding, but the lyrics too, you know, the lyrics are about, you know, okay, you think you were such a hot shot and you've had all this fun in your life, but it's too late, you know, it's too late for you now. Your turn is over and other people are going to have fun now. And why don't you just be quiet, you know, something like that. And, you know, it's kind of an insult song, but it's one that you can easily turn against yourself as a way to not take yourself too seriously and not take your problems too seriously because they're nothing, you know. I like the person that I fell in love with was really into yoga, and I had never tried it in my life. And so I started doing some stretches with her and stuff, and I was really getting into doing stretches. I found that like the breathing and the stretching and stuff made me feel better and made me feel a little more like under control while I was having all my, you know, life freakouts and emotional roller coaster stuff. But I also found that like, you know, that whole yoga thing made me start think about meditation. And I was thinking about, you know, how people sometimes have mantras or they have, you know, a certain, you know, deep breathing thing or like something they'll tell themselves or affirmations or things, you know, that they will try to keep in their mind throughout the day. And whenever they need to calm down or chill out or whatever, they'll sort of reach for this thing and it will, you know, through lots of practice will help calm them down. Well, I realized, why couldn't you do that with like the first two bars of of this Little Walter song? And like literally for months, like any time I was feeling like stressed out or like I wasn't handling my emotions very well, I would just like think to the intro of this song, It's Too Late, Brother, and it would like really like make me feel so much better. And like sometimes I'd have to write emails, you know, band emails or whatever, you know, just business junk, admin, whatever. And you know, it's like I didn't feel like in the right place to send a cheerful email. So I would think about this song and it would help me think of something funny to write in the email. And I just felt like, you know, for a few months in there, this thing just like totally saved my life. And so this song was absolutely enormous for me. That one and another one called Mellow Down Easy were ones that I was just listening to. It's not playing them out loud through speakers. I was playing them in my mind on a kind of constant loop, and found that I was able to hang on to some kind of sanity with the aid of Little Walter. And so I feel like eternally grateful to Little Walter. The existence of that concept and that attitude towards life is so I just, as much as like American popular music is dominated by African Americans, I still feel that it's underappreciated the magnitude and the scope of the accomplishment of turning oppression and centuries of oppression into medicine. You know, that then is made available to everyone, and anyone who maybe they don't feel oppressed, but they feel that they're having some kind of something go wrong in their life. You know, this music is there, and has sympathy, and it has offered itself for everyone's use. And the magnitude of the generosity of that offering from an oppressed and or marginalized and or underappreciated And, you know, I mean, largely enslaved segment of our culture, just seems to me to be like one of the greatest gifts that you could point to in human history from one group of people to the rest of the human race. And I do feel, I mean, whatever, everybody has their favorite songs or whatever, but like, to me, this Little Walter expresses a lot of that for me, and so I wanted to express in this podcast my appreciation for it because, you know, that some kind of gratitude, really, for all three of the songs, for music in general, you know, that's why I kind of like the theme of your podcast, because it was like a chance to thank artists and to thank songs for not just making a song that gets a 10 out of 10 on Pitchfork, but for making a song that like helps you build your own character, helps you, you know, realize yourself as a person or whatever. You know, it's quite huge. And it is funny how, you know, music always seems like a decoration or an extra in life. When we should be worried about making money instead. But the fact is that it just seems like every culture since the beginning of time has always needed music and always made music, and it actually does seem to have some huge value for people down through the ages all across the globe, and so I think it's fun to be able to talk about how songs might have helped create who you are as a human being. So this has been fun to chat. Mother, brother, ain't no need of going no further, man. You had diamonds and Cadillac cars, touring the world and sitting up bars. Ain't no need of going no further now.
Essential Tremors is hosted and distributed by AudioStack and WYPR Baltimore. Look for and subscribe to our podcasts at wypr.org/podcastcentral, including Life in the Balance, a monthly program that asks, what are the systemic issues in Baltimore that keep marginalized people from reaching their full potential? And what are the solutions to those problems? Also new to WYPR is The Noir and Bizarre, which explores the dark and strange stories we tell ourselves about human existence, occult history, ghosts, haunted houses, and secret crimes, with a special emphasis on stories that draw on the rich history and culture of Baltimore. For more information about Essential Tremors or to connect with us, go to essentialpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.